What I'm trying to explain to you is, come in.
You said you wanted to see me, Mrs. Walker.
Come right in.
Hello there. Good to see you again.
It's nice to see you.
You're awfully lucky, Mrs. Walker. Lovely little girl you have here.
Thank you. And Susan's the reason I asked you to drop down. She's a little confused, and I thought maybe you could help to straighten her out.
I'd be glad to.
Would you please tell her that you're not really Santa Claus? That there actually is no such person?
Well, I'm sorry to disagree with you, Mrs. Walker, but not only is there such a person, but here I am to prove it.
No. You misunderstand.
Clip from the classic 1947 film Miracle on 34th Street. We're counting down our favourite festive films on this special Christmas edition of The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
Cinema needs to evolve and needs to have some spectacle and needs to have some sense of occasion, I think. Outdoor cinemas and rooftop cinema, I think, delivers some of that.
If you're not really dreaming of a white Christmas, well, we'll take you on a trip to the other side of the world where December means sunny days and movies outside. And a little later.
George stands there, overcome and speechless as he holds Zuzu. As he sees the familiar faces, he gives them a sick grin. Tears course down his face. His lips frame their names as he greets them.
Settle in for a fireside story as we revisit the original script of 1946's It's a Wonderful Life. That's all to come on this Christmas cracker edition of The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
Deck the hall with boughs of holly, fa-la-la-la-la, fa-la-la-la.
The carolers are singing, the Christmas bells are ringing. It is, of course, our special Christmas edition of The Cinema Show, coming to you from Midori House here in London. It is, of course, around this time of year that cinemas just about everywhere start giving their festive favourites another rotation. So if you're like me and can't quite get enough of all that over-sweetened, wholesome festive fun, then stay tuned because I'm joined again by The Cinema Show's very own Christmas correspondent, Tara Judah. Tara, welcome. Now, you actually have a list of films that you watch around this time of year, don't you?
It's quite extensive. I usually start halfway through November and try and cram in as many screenings as I can up until the end of December and sometimes into January if it's still feeling seasonal.
Tara, controversial as it might be, I'd like to start with one of my favourites, of which I know you're not exactly so fond. Here's a bit of a clue for you.
What is that? What are you doing? What is that? What are you doing? You're taking all the caviar? That caviar is a garnish.
Look, the reason I came into your store is because I was spending the day with Annabelle and Matt, and I was buying them presents. I'm the type of guy who likes to buy his way into the hearts of children who are his relatives. There's only one place to find a children's book in the neighborhood. That will not always be the case. And it was yours, and it is a charming little bookstore. You probably sell, what, $350,000 worth of books in a year?
How did you know that?
I'm in the book business.
I'm in the book business.
A postcard perfect picture of New York at Christmas with Meg Ryan. In a 90s romantic comedy, it is, of course, You've Got Mail, directed by the late, great Nora Ephron and based upon the 1940 film by Ernst Lubitsch, The Shop Around the Corner, which was itself based on a 1937 Hungarian play called Parfumery by Miklos Laszlo. Tara, it's all froth and fun, isn't it?
I don't hate the film, but there is something about those romantic comedies, Sleepless in Seattle, When Harry Met Sally, there's a series of those types of romantic comedies that I'm not really into. I think that they give a false suggestion of female empowerment. I don't really find them honest in the way that they try and equate the sexuality between the two characters. And I know that that's the thing that other people really do like about these films often, is that they feel like the females get a better center in these movies than some of the others. I would add to that list, though, the films that I also am not super into. So for any real romantics, you're going to be disappointed. I don't love The Holiday with Cameron Diaz and...
Nobody loves that movie. Except my mother. Sorry, Mum.
There is a horde of people who enjoy it. Love Actually, I'm not at all a fan of.
Oh, God, no.
Yeah, it's a terrible film, and there's a number of great articles online about why it's so bad, so we won't go into that here.
Exactly.
Also, the films like Bridget Jones's Diary, which, you know, these kind of films that really wallow in sentimentality.
It's written in front of me. That's on my list. What are you doing to me, Tara?
I'm sorry, but I do like the original types of films that they reference, which is things like Shop Around the Corner, It's a Wonderful
yes.
Life, Holiday Inn, you know, all of these original kind of romantic Christmas films, the black and white ones. And the reason I like them is not because they're black and white and I'm a colour movie snob, but it's actually more because what we get in those films is, I think, a little bit more genuine just because they come straight out of the post-war era. And those films are, they really earnestly capture what the Christmas spirit in cinema is all about. I mean, this is where, I mean, the history of Christmas on cinema goes all the way back to 1898 with a short film called Santa Claus, which you can watch on YouTube if you're interested. So
it's a little bit spooky, actually.
It is.
Maybe it's something about being an old black and white silent movie, but it's just something. There's something about the jerky movements of Santa Claus creeping into the house that screams to me home invasion, not Christmas morning.
See, I think it's the real stockings that are actually like probably quite dirty. I imagine in 1898 they probably weren't that clean.
No,
that's the bit that's a bit creepy for me. But we've got this grand tradition of visual trickery, illusion, excitement, the Christmas spirit. But I think what we get by the time we get to post-war era, where we start to see American movies particularly taking on this genre and making it into something else, and why some of these romantic films particularly become Christmas films, is because they're about the idea of hope and heteronormativity. And I mean, you know, I'm not saying heteronormativity is a good thing, but we have to discuss it if we're talking about Christmas films.
Absolutely, about romantic comedies in general.
It comes into all of them, because that is really post-war what America is looking for on screen, is this promise of the future again, and that comes down to procreation and children.
Come on now, it isn't as bad as that.
I'd forgotten how much that woman hates me and how much I hate her. That's a terrible thing to say, isn't it? Ever since I was little, she was always so right and I was always so wrong.
Remember the Night is a 1940 film from director Mitchell Leeson and the legendary filmmaker Preston Sturges, serving here as screenwriter for the last time before he made the leap into the director's chair. The film opens in New York during the Christmas shopping rush, with Barbara Stanwyck playing a shoplifter who, after getting caught, eventually finds herself spending an unlikely Christmas with the family of the district attorney. Tara, this is such a lovely life-affirming story, isn't it?
It is. And actually, there's also a contemporary remake of this with Mark Ruffalo, and I think it's Mary Stuart Masterson, set in Upper New York. And she's got a little, actually, it's slightly different, but it's pretty much the same film. She has a daughter. They're a klepto duo and they steal things, and then she gets caught and sentenced to spend the holidays with him because they can't put her in jail and they can't have a trial or whatever over the holidays. It's a really ridiculous premise, but a very similar story. And it's the same thing. And I actually like the contemporary remake as well. I mean, I love Barbara Stanwyck. We'll get to how amazing she is in just a second. She really is wonderful. But what I like about that story is, again, it's this idea of putting yourself in somebody else's shoes. The really successful Christmas films always do that. They ask you to view things slightly differently and to think about the less fortunate at this time of year. Those are really the best films. Like, what is it that we are talking about at this time of year? Like, how much we matter to other people and we can help them. What it's like for people who are less fortunate than ourselves, and how maybe we could do something to make that a little bit better, or just be a bit more compassionate in our everyday lives. But Barbara Stanwyck is an absolute powerhouse. I think she's one of the most magnificent melodrama stars. I love watching her. And I say one of the things that I find a bit difficult with this pairing, though, is that I think McMurray's a little soft for her. He doesn't quite have... I mean, I don't know who would. I'm not sure who I need to see sparring against her to be completely won over by them as a duo. I'm not sure if he's a lovable rogue. Like, he's kind of got this teddy bear look going on, but I don't think he's fiery enough for her.
Well, that's what I find so fascinating about Barbara Stanwyck, though, is that when we say that she's a very strong actress, she plays very strong characters, Not always, because the magic part about her performance, when you compare her to someone like Joan Crawford or Bette Davis and so on, these very, very strong domineering women, none of those people that we think of this era had the same ability to also simultaneously communicate fragility. And that's what I find is the key to her success. No matter what film you're watching her in, there's always this ability for her to communicate these very, very subtle flaws, these subtle human flaws, just with the way that she might say something or an expression on her face. She does it not with words, but with actions. And that seems to me like a very modern style of acting. To be honest, I watch her with Fred McMurray in the many pairings that they had together, and I can't fault any of the times that I've seen them on screen together.
Yeah, maybe I'm being a bit harsh on Mr. McMurray. He's all right.
He's okay. All right.
Also, just as a kind of tip to anyone who loves Barbara Stanwyck as a little exercise, is to watch a Barbara Stanwyck film and take your eyes off the screen for a while and imagine Kathleen Turner, because they kind of have the same voice.
No.
Yes.
Is that true?
And then you can watch films like Serial Mom and imagine it's Barbara Stanwyck, which gives a whole new dimension entirely.
That's incredible. I'm going to do that immediately. Thanks to the Cinema Show's Christmas correspondent, Tara Judah. Next week, we'll review the best and worst of 2016's film offerings with David Jenkins from Little White Lies magazine. Now, if you've been listening to the show throughout the year, you'll have heard our series of extracts from the as-yet-unpublished autobiography of a film critic for a once prestigious Metropolitan Daily newspaper. We thought we'd heard it all, but yet another chapter landed on the Cinema Show's desk this week. Who knew the disgruntled critic even celebrated Christmas?
Memoirs of a Disgruntled Critic, Christmas Chapter. I think it was John Cassavetes who said to me over a particularly indecorous game of Russian roulette that Christmas movies are the human race's punishment for its overweening hubris. He was in a particularly volatile mood at the time, as studio pressure was being brought to bear to convince him to change the lead character in The Killing of a Chinese Bookie to a sexually adventurous shopping mall Santa. Still, I found wisdom in what he said, and ever since I have endeavoured, when assessing the merits of seasonal cinema, to hate practically everything. Some might call me a curmudgeon for my attitude to festive films, but I prefer to think of it as a discerning approach that illustrates the intellectual heft that I bring to the art of critique. Too many modern critics are easily seduced by the flash of a fur-trimmed overcoat and the point of an elf's ear, and they gush unadulterated effluent over the purveyors of Yuletide pap. I am proud to say I've never fallen victim to this. As I outlined in my 1984 book, How Christmas Destroyed Hollywood and Made Me Chronically Suicidal, the holidays have been a source of some of the most outrageous offences against good taste yet discovered outside the oeuvre of Ryan O'Neill. The main issue that arises with the average Christmas movie is, of course, that of Santa Claus himself. Time and again, we are forced to sit through movies in which Father Christmas is real, but not believed in by parents, and nobody makes a solitary peep about the gaping plot hole this creates. Because if Santa is real, who, I ask you, reasonable cinema goer, do the parents think is leaving all the presents? Most Christmas films are set in a universe in which millions of people think there is a mysterious intruder breaking into their home once a year and are completely comfortable with this. Every Christmas, gifts show up in the house of their own accord, and still these cretins are flabbergasted when their revolting offspring reveal that the magical fat man is real. Wouldn't a movie where everyone on Earth believed in Santa, who was suffering a nervous breakdown due to the intolerable glare of the public eye, be more realistic, more expressive of the late modern malaise? Or even better, a movie where everyone not only believed in Santa, but was hunting him, causing him to run for his life through the densely booby-trapped wasteland of the Arctic. The potential of such a film is huge, yet nobody in today's trash toilet of a film industry has the guts to make it. Not all Christmas movies revolve around problematic Santas, of course. Take most people's favourite Christmas film, Die Hard. Many wax rhapsodic about this orgiastic bullet monsoon, thus proving their own cerebral vacancy. Leaving aside the appalling cultural appropriation on display in hiring Englishman Alan Rickman to play a German criminal mastermind when so many talented Germans were available. Klaus Kinski, Herbert Grönemeyer, Brigitte Nielsen et al. Die Hard presents us with a vision of Christmas that barely resembles the reality that ordinary working-class men and women live with every day. As long as we perpetuate the stereotype that Christmas is all about gunplay and walking on broken glass, we are bound to end each year dissatisfied with our lot. And so, when asked for my favourite Christmas films, I name just two. Mike Leigh's Christmas Never Came to Watford and Zeffirelli's Herbie Goes Crackers. Outside this, holiday-themed cinema is a grim parade of banality that serves but one purpose, to remind us all of the blessed brevity of life. Merry Christmas.
Still to come, it's a marshmallow world in the winter, but if you're not enjoying it quite as much as Bing Crosby did, well, stay tuned. We'll take you to a place where movies are best enjoyed outside on a warm evening. This is The Cinema Show. More to come.
Do you like bad movies? No, neither do we. But don't worry, we've discovered a cure for bad films. It's called MUBI.
Sometimes Wells's films aren't very nourishing, they're very exciting. Citizen Kane, I think, absolutely wins the competition for the film that has made more people want to become a filmmaker than any other.
Every day, MUBI adds a new must-see film to its carefully curated selection. No junk-filled mess or endless scrolling. Just an assembly of the best movies from all over the world waiting to be devoured. To sample a whole month of movies for free, just head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Hurry now, the film's about to start.
Welcome back to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. Now, for most people in the Northern Hemisphere, Christmas conjures up images of cold weather, woolen jumpers, and snow-laden pine trees. In Australia, however, the holiday season means something completely different. Temperatures often rise well above 30 degrees, and it's not uncommon for the end-of-year Christmas party to take place on the beach. On the hottest days, the air can feel so thick, and the days are long, the clouds are always few. It's easy to understand then why a new Christmas tradition has started to emerge in Australia, one that's best enjoyed after the hot summer sun has set. Public parks and urban rooftops across the country are transformed into outdoor cinemas that give patrons the opportunity to get out of their homes and enjoy a film beneath the balmy night sky. It might all sound like a simple pleasure, but for organisers, curating a successful outdoor screening program is often hard work. Monocle's Adrian Craddock recently spoke to Eddie Tamir. He's a former actor who owns three cinemas across Melbourne, including one in Hawthorne called Lido, which shows a lot of movies on its rooftop. Eddie started off by explaining how he started out in the cinema business.
So after I was working as a producer, I was looking at getting into cinemas, and I was, as I said, attracted to original cinema buildings. So I got this little dirty pale blue pamphlet, which was produced by the Cinema and Theatre Historical Society, and it was, I think it's about 10 pages, and it goes through every location in Victoria that had ever been a cinema, and goes through, you know, if it's an existing building, if it's a bingo hall, if it's demolished, if it's a skyscraper, if it's operating, blah, blah, blah. So I actually went to every single location in that pamphlet to get a real sense of what was left intact in terms of original cinema buildings. And it so happens that the classic is one and the cameo is another and the Lido is a third.
One of the most striking features of this cinema is the rooftop space. Can you tell me a little bit about that space and how it's used?
Rooftops in general are very exciting. They always give a different perspective on the world and on the suburb and the city that you're in. And our rooftop's no exception to that, and you get an amazing panoramic view of, you know, the leafy suburbs and church steeples of Melbourne. And on our rooftop, we have a permanent cinema setup, full, you know, DCP cinema projection of the highest standard. We negotiated with council on a sound option. Because of respect for neighbours, we actually have a headphone, Dolby digital headphones, that we deliver the sound through.
Rather than speakers, each patron has a little headset they have.
That's right. So that is respectful to the neighbours, as well as actually gives an amazing sound, because a lot of rooftop and outdoor cinemas don't really have high fidelity sound and don't have best vision and sight lines because they're in parks or they're in, I guess, situations that make it very difficult to deliver quality. So our sound and vision is fantastic. And the other element to our offer is that we are, because we're in a cinema, part of a cinema complex, we deliver first release films. So week one, day one, on the roof, tonight, midnight screening of Star Wars inside as well as on the rooftop at midnight. Not many outdoor cinemas can create that experience because it'll usually be Star Wars in 3 months' time.
Why was it so important for you to have an outdoor cinema in this complex?
Cinema needs to evolve and needs to have some spectacle and needs to have some sense of occasion, I think, and needs to have some specialness. And outdoor cinemas and rooftop cinema, I think, delivers some of that. And, yeah, so that's part of our offer.
What do you think makes a really top-notch outdoor cinema as far as kind of the design and the experience goes?
You know, as I said, everyone's got their elements. I mean, the Botanical Gardens has got the Botanical Gardens. The, you know, open air in St Kilda has got St Kilda Beach. We have, you know, our inner city urban landscape with first release films, with our particular aesthetic and our particular eclectic mix. You know, the Cameo Cinemas has got the temperate rainforest and the Dandenong Ranges as its outlook, and the sun sets behind the screen and the Belgrave train line is, the train is visible running under our screen, giving a bit of colour and movement, together with owls and possums that, you know, populate the Dandenongs, which come to visit, you know, and view the film together with the customers, because cinemas themselves are very rigid, whereas outdoors is more in the spirit of, oh yeah, we're kind of cabaret seating style, where it's not formalised, we're not necessarily sitting elbow to elbow with someone, you know, in a rigid environment that is just absolutely pristine in the dark and no sound can be made. So, you know, there is more casualness in an outdoor. So no, it's not about comfort totally, but it's about ease and freedom, I suppose, in the spirit of just being able to kind of, you know, lie around.
Lido Cinema's Eddie Tamir there, speaking to Monocle's Melbourne correspondent Adrian Craddock. As we were counting down our favourite Christmas movies earlier in today's show, you might have noticed that we left off one rather conspicuous title. It's the one that listeners across the world, especially over in the United States, will be tuning into via its annual television outing about this time of year. But even if you've seen this film hundreds of times already, and really, who hasn't, you probably haven't seen the original screenplay. We present you now with a reading of a classic scene from the 1946 film, It's a Wonderful Life.
Hey! Merry Christmas, Mr. Potter!
Happy New Year to you! In jail! Going home, they're waiting.
Interior, living room, night. Close shot. Mary leads George, who is carrying a couple of kids on his back, to a position in front of the Christmas tree. Mary. Come on in here, now. You stand right over here, right by the tree. Right there. And don't move, don't move. I hear him now. George, it's a miracle. It's a miracle. She runs towards the front of the door and flings it open. Sounds of excited crowds can be heard. Uncle Billy, faced, flushed, covered with snow, and carrying a clothes basket filled with money, bursts in. He's followed by Ernie and about 20 more townspeople. Mary. Come in, Uncle Billy. Everybody, it's here. Uncle Billy, Mary, and the crowd come into the living room. A table stands in front of George. George picks up Zuzu to protect her from the mob. Uncle Billy dumps a basket of money onto the table. The money overflows and falls all over. Uncle Billy, isn't it wonderful? The rest of the crowd all greet George with greetings and smiles. Each one comes forward with money in their pockets, in shoeboxes, in coffee pots. Money pours onto the table. Pennies, dimes, quarters, dollar bills, small money, but lots of it. Mrs. Bailey and Mrs. Hatch push towards George. More people come in. The place becomes bedlam. Shouts of gangway, gangway, as a new bunch comes in and pours its money. Mary stands next to George, watching him. George stands there, overcome and speechless, as he holds Zuzu. As he sees the familiar faces, he gives them a sick grin. Tears course down his face. His lips frame their names as he greets them. Uncle Billy. Brackets, emotionally at breaking point, close brackets. Mary did it, George. Mary did it. She told a few people you were in trouble and they scattered all over town collecting money. They didn't ask any questions, just said, if George is in trouble, count on me. You never saw anything like it. Tom comes in, digging in his purse as he comes.
Come in, George. Now don't say anything.
Once more, the crowd breaks into cheering and applause. Janie at the piano and Bert on his accordion start playing Auld Lang Syne and everyone joins in. Close shot. George, still holding Zuzu in his arms, glances down at the pile of money on the table. His eye catches something on top of the pile and he reaches down for it. It's Clarence's copy of Tom Sawyer. George opens it and finds an inscription written in it. Quote, Dear George, remember, no man is a failure who has friends. Thanks for the wings. Love, Clarence. Close quotes. Mary, looking at the book. What's that? George, that is a Christmas present from a very dear friend. At this moment, perhaps because of the jostling of some of the people on the other side of the tree, a little silvery bell on the Christmas tree swings to and fro with a silvery twinkle. Zuzu closes the cover of the book and points to the bell. Zuzu, look, Daddy. Teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings. George, brackets smiling, close brackets. That's right. He looks towards the ceiling and winks. George, attaboy, Clarence. The voices of the people singing swell into the final crescendo for the fade out. The end.
A classic scene there from a classic movie. Our thanks to Gillian DeBias for reading that extract from the original screenplay of It's a Wonderful Life. The story is by Philip Van Doren Stern, and the script was written by Francis Goodrich, Albert Hackett, Joe Swerling, and Michael Wilson, and, of course, the great Frank Capra. Well, that's it for this week's program. Tune in next week for our end-of-year review. We'll pick out the best and worst of 2016 and hear from some of this year's most fascinating voices of the screen, including Todd Solondz, Xavier Dolan, and, of course, Ken Loach. That's coming up next week on The Cinema Show. Today's program was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your audio. The Cinema Show is back next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Happy Christmas.